एक मिनट रुक जाओ, रेडी होने दो। चलो ये कर लेते हैं, दिस कुड बी अ ग्रेट इंट्रो।
हाय, आई एम अक्षय।
हाय, दिस इज सौरभ एंड यू आर लिसनिंग टू द फाउंडर थीसिस पॉडकास्ट। वी मीट सम ऑफ द मोस्ट सेलिब्रेटेड स्टार्टअप फाउंडर्स इन द कंट्री
एंड वी वांट टू लर्न हाउ टू बिल्ड अ यूनिकॉर्न।
I'm Greg Moran. I'm the co-founder and CEO of Zoomcar.
Have you heard about Agnes Kongsha Boyashiu? No, neither had I until I googled Mother Teresa. Yes, that was her name before she came to India. And just like Agnes, today Akshay Dutt is talking to another foreigner who came to India to solve big Indian problems at scale. Greg Moran's journey from pursuing a master's in business from an Ivy League B school to scaling up Zoomcar is a fascinating one, and it's a journey like no other. He's someone who is driven by a passion to solve global ecological problems and has decided to handle all the challenges of building a startup along with all the challenges of doing it in a country where he doesn't speak the native language and has no roots in. Listen to his candid conversation with Akshay Dutt to discover some unique outsider and insider perspectives about doing business in India.
I would say, you know, certainly a healthy amount of travel. We kind of had, you know, pretty diverse travel where we would always go on at least two or three trips a year. Usually one trip international and then, you know, one or two trips domestically. From the time I was, a pretty small kid. Right from the time I was probably 6 or 7, is when we would, have, consistent travel, to these different destinations. So, I still remember my first time abroad was when, we went to Italy when I was 8. And so that was, definitely, very kind of opening and, enlightening for me. And, then...
When was your first time to India? Did your parents take you to India?
No. So my first time in India was actually much, much later. So certainly not when I was 8. No, that was actually when we were just starting up for Zoomcar. So yeah, actually I was, at that point I was 26.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. By the time you were finishing up high school, did you know what you wanted to do with your life?
No, certainly not. I mean, I think very few people, I believe at the age of 17 or 18, really know what they want to do. And, even if they kind of tell you what they want to do, more often than not, that typically changes, right? I think, at that point, I knew I was going to University of Pennsylvania, and I knew I was going to be, doing something within sort of, broader business, law, politics, economics. So I had this, sort of loose, vague idea that I was going to study, those areas. But in terms of, what that would, actually mean or what that would actually translate to, I really didn't have much of an idea. So I thought at that point, I didn't honestly really know that many sort of occupations or jobs, so to speak. I knew, I knew vaguely that, you could be kind of like a lawyer, or you could be a, a banker, or you could, maybe, be a consultant. Honestly, at that point, I didn't even really know what those careers actually meant. My parents, came from, more modest backgrounds, and, they were kind of much more like middle class type jobs. So I knew I didn't want to be an accountant, and I knew I didn't want to be a tax accountant. I knew I didn't want to be a nurse or, go into medical malpractice law. So I knew I didn't want to do for sure what my parents did. But, apart from that, it was obviously still pretty open.
So, like in India, when you get into a college, you like pre-select what you want to do. Is it the same for the US also? Like you had to decide in advance what you want to do and apply for that specific program? Or is it more flexible where you can join and figure out what you want to do?
No, it's much more the latter. As I'm sure you're aware, the US is not nearly that prescriptive. I think you select the college you'll be in, as in the school, meaning that you have to kind of, broadly select if you want to do engineering or business or, arts and sciences, et cetera. So you have, at a, most macro level, you kind of select it that way. But you're certainly not selecting like a major or a minor or, you know, a specific focus area. So it's at a, you know, very high level. And even that, there's flexibility and you can change as you go along.
So what is it like studying at an Ivy school in the US? Is it like the 1% are your peers over there? Or, you know, what is that whole experience like, those 4 years that you spent at UPenn?
Like, right.
How did you
Right. Well, yeah, no, I was incredibly fortunate to be at UPenn. You know, I think it was obviously an amazing experience for probably a number of reasons. I think it's really, you know, like with anything, you know, whether you talk about, you know, being at a, you know, a company that you really enjoy, or, you know, being in a school you really enjoy, it's really about the people, right? So I think it's always about the people. And, you know, that's really the name of the game. And I think what I really enjoyed the most about, you know, being at a school like Penn is that you're surrounded by, you know, really incredible folks across the board. I mean, obviously, you know, it certainly goes without saying that, you know, everyone was very, you know, accomplished, you know, academically. I think that that was kind of more sort of table stakes. I think, yeah, there's a lot of schools where people are accomplished academically in the U.S. I think it's more that, you know, the well-roundedness of the people. I think the overall, you know, passion that was there, the overall, you know, attitude, and, you know, sort of that, you know, sort of progressive element of really wanting to make a positive impact on society. I think that was the piece that was most infectious. And I think, you know, especially with my circle, my close circle of friends, I think that was obviously what, you know, was really always front and center. And I think that's where, you know, there's a, you know, very common, a sort of very, you know, clear sort of meeting of the minds. And I think that's what, you know, probably made it, you know, so special and valuable for me, is that, you know, your closest friends and, you know, the learning that you have outside of the classroom. You know, I think, you know, most people will tell you that, you know, in college, yeah, you obviously, there's maybe a little bit that you learn in the classroom, but, you know, if you look at the overall learning you have in college, probably 90% of that learning comes outside of the classroom.
Okay. And how did your life view change during those 4 years?
Well, I think you're exposed to a lot more, right? So, I mean, growing up in the suburbs, you know, I didn't grow up in the city. So, you know, when you grow up in the suburbs, it's a lot more insulated. So, you know, you have a much more narrow worldview. You don't have the same perspectives. When you're at a, you know, a big school, you know, that has a lot of international folks, a lot of people from different backgrounds, very geographically diverse, you know, you actually end up, you know, developing a much more sort of full-bodied understanding of, you know, various issues. And, you know, it really, you know, paints a different perspective. So
did your ambitions change? Like, you know, did you get more goal clarity by the end of those 4 years?
Yeah, I think so, for sure. Because, you know, you're just exposed to a lot more, right? So I think you definitely have a much better pulse for what is out there and, you know, what is possible. And yeah, I think definitely the fact that you're surrounded by people from all over the world, there's, you know, so many different, you know, extracurriculars that you have an opportunity to pursue as well. And I think that, you know, more than anything is probably what, you know, pushes you in certain directions. And, you know, you're obviously exposed to people who are, you know, older than you, who are, you know, going down certain paths. And so, you know, you can obviously, you know, sort of pick their brains and learn from them. So yeah, I think it's just the broader exposure that you have, and, you know, the type of interactions that you have on a day-to-day basis is what makes it, I think, so impactful and so special.
So by the end of it, you wanted to be an investment banker? Like, you joined like a PE firm. So Fieldstone is a PE firm, right? Like,
so that's an investment bank. So yeah, it's actually an investment bank within the broader energy infra space, clean tech space. So yeah, no, definitely it was something which was very appealing to me personally, because of the mission and the goal of the firm, which was, you know, really to play an active role in helping to finance and transform the energy infrastructure spaces. So for me, it was never about, you know, investment banking or private equity. I mean, that was always just a means to an end, right? I mean, I don't think anyone, well, I guess I shouldn't say this, but I don't think anyone really comes out of school saying like, oh, I want to be an investment banker per se. I think it's, you know, more that, you know, at least from my vantage point, I was always passionate about the industry. So I was passionate about sustainability. I was always passionate about the environment.
Why were you passionate about sustainability?
Yeah, I think, well, that I sort of had already highlighted a little bit. I think it was, for me, it was very clear that, you know, if you kind of, you know, zoom out for a minute, pull out and, you know, think about the really bigger picture, you know, urban sustainability is by far the most important issue of our time. Because, you know, if you don't have cities that are growing sustainably, you know, then you just have actual calamity on your hands, where you have massive amounts of congestion, you have massive amounts of pollution, you have, you know, very, very poor planning development, and then, you know, quality of life suffers dramatically, and then everything starts to break down. You know, that's so, obviously extreme scenario.
That's like the logical reason, but what is the emotional reason that you got passionate about it?
No, that, I mean, that is the reason, right? So I think it hits you over the head, and it's so impactful, right? So that is the emotional reason, right? Like if you look at those statistics, I mean, just looking at the numbers, right? So, you know, think about, you know, cities like in India, you know, where you have, you know, 14 out of the 15 most polluted cities, air quality wise. And then you kind of, you know, whenever you read these statistics, you're also, you know, oftentimes seeing imagery around it. I think having visited a lot of these places, then, you know, it's something also, even growing up in New York and being in the city, like, you know, you can see, and, you know, New York is obviously a lot better than, you know, cities like, say, Bangalore or Delhi in terms of pollution and congestion. But, you know, even being in New York, I mean, you can see visibly the effects. I mean, you can feel it. And, you know, I think growing up, I actually, there was a time at least where I suffered from asthma, you know, in terms of, you know, bad air quality. And, you know, I think a lot of people in the big cities in the US would suffer from asthma, you know, because of the air quality and, you know, because of the pollution. So, yeah, I mean, I think that always is part of it. But I think, you know, you can just, you know, sort of see those statistics and, you know, it becomes, you know, painfully obvious. And whatever you read about, you know, broader forecasts around, you know, what's going to happen to, you know, water supply, what's going to happen to the food supply, you know, what's going to happen, you know, when it comes to energy supply. So all of that, you know, just kind of hits you over the head.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. So what kind of work were you doing at Fieldstone?
So I was an investment banking analyst associate, and, you know, so I was doing a lot of, you know, financial modeling and, you know, a lot of detailed analysis around, you know, financial structures, et cetera. But, you know, I think for me, I mean, that was obviously the functional aspect of it. I took the time to learn a huge amount about the renewable sector and looking at solar, wind, energy storage, et cetera. And so at the time we were building out a fledgling practice on the renewable side. And so I really took a liking, of course, to that. And I realized that that's where there could be a large impact. And so I started to focus, you know, really all of my time, you know, there, you know, on renewables and, you know, different, you know, deal opportunities out there. And, you know, I even, you know, tried to, you know, be very active, very proactive in sourcing, you know, new business for the company. And so sourced a lot of new business for the company in terms of renewables.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So, and you also kind of were doing sales in a way then when you were getting new business. Getting in new business. So it meant like you would network with people and kind of right. Go and attend events and stuff like that. Like, how does that happen in an investment bank, like finding new clients?
I mean, you would do all of that. I think there's no one answer, but you know, I think if you look at it's kind of an all of the above approach. I mean, a lot of it obviously comes from the existing network. And then, you know, there's opportunities to expand that network through, you know, different introductions, et cetera. But, you know, then, yeah, there's more sort of inorganic ways of going to different events and, you know, going to different conferences and seminars where you end up meeting a lot of folks. Some of it's just cold calling, to be honest. So, you know, it really depends. So I think, you know, it's always best if you have a warm introduction, if there's some sort of common intersection. I think, you know, wherever you can, you obviously try to avoid cold calling. But I think, you know, we had, you know, we were fortunate that we had a very good brand name in that space. So within the renewable, you know, clean tech space, everyone kind of knew Fieldstone. And I think that really helped, you know, because, you know, whenever you have a good brand name, you know, you can always leverage and lean on that, and it becomes a lot easier.
Okay, okay. And then you switched and joined like International Power America. So what was the role there and why did you make the switch?
Sure. So that was more of like a private equity type role where we were doing direct investing from the company's balance sheet. So, this takes me way back. So that, we were really, looking at, building out our own proprietary investment book within the energy space, especially within renewables. And so again, was doing a lot of transactions within wind, solar and storage. And, we had a pretty broad global mandate geographically. So we were looking at, opportunities really across the board. So it was not just in, Northeast or not just in, the South and, or, just in the US. So it was that way pretty diverse and broad. So that was actually a really great experience because since we were not advisors, I mean, we were, directly handling that and dealing there, the learning was actually, very significant. And, it was, since it's also an operating company, unlike an advisory shop, unlike an investment bank, there's a lot of people who are technical. So there's a lot of engineers. There's a lot of people who are kind of, experts in the energy space, et cetera, right? So, those people, really will, give you a huge amount of learning on the industry. And so that was, I think, for us also equally important.
Okay. Okay. And were you also traveling around the world at this time?
Yeah, so we were. I mean, so yeah, I traveled for work and then also just obviously continued to travel for fun, for pleasure. So it was a combination.
By this time, had you visited India?
No. I only visited India after I left that role. I visited India for the first time right before business school. So that was in 2000.
So why did you make that decision to leave? I mean, you were enjoying here quite a bit and with both investment and operational exposure. So why leave and go to a business school?
Well, I knew that I wanted to kind of get into, either venture capital or, go and do something on my own. So I think that was something which was very clear to me from, 2010, 2011, I knew I was kind of trending on that path. And playing venture capital, that was always appealing because it was kind of getting into the technology aspect of it. And I think I started to shift more when I was in International Power. I think what I realized is that, learning about the industry and going deep on the industry in terms of the technical aspects of it, the market aspects of it, that was really what was fascinating. So really having a depth around the knowledge of the industry was what was most appealing. And so I think that's where I felt, either, going and doing something on my own in the space, in the broader sort of sustainability space, or doing something on the venture capital side, would actually be the most rewarding. And, I think I realized quickly that, venture capital, at least, probably it was not really the right time in terms of entry. I think it's, much, much better to kind of do that when you're a little bit older in life. So yeah, I think if you have a lot of experience, if you have practical real world experience, it becomes a lot more impactful to actually be a strong venture capitalist and a strong investor. So I felt that that was something to be looked at much later in life, much later. And, focusing on, the current sort of here and now was going to be, much more impactful.
Okay. And so once you quit International Power America, this is where you went to India. So this was like a couple of months off you took to travel. Like that was.
Yeah. So before business school, I think, in the US and I think in India, it's the same is that, typically people take some downtime between, their job and start a business school. For me, I was again, fortunate and lucky that I had this opportunity. Yeah, I wanted to.
What do you remember about that trip to India, which you took?
I remember everything. So it was pretty
what
hard.
What was like your first impression? As soon as you deboarded.
Yeah. Well, it was pretty crazy actually, because for me, when I actually got out, I had to. I landed in the old Mumbai airport. So this was before the international terminal was really built out. So this, you know, was 2011. So the international terminal was just getting completed at that point, you know, T2 in Bombay. And so I flew Air India, you know, and so, you know, Air India was pretty brutal, you know, direct from Mumbai. It's not, at that point I wasn't flying business class. So that was, you know, pretty painful 14.5 hour, you know, 14 hour flight. So yeah, long haul for sure. When I remember, you know, when I got out, it was funny because, you know, I was staying, I had a rough itinerary for what I wanted to do, for the 3 months, plus.
What was the itinerary?
It was just in terms of cities, right? So I was going to go to, like, you know, 25 cities and, you know, so I was going to, you know,
25 spend, cities. Amazing.
Yeah. So, you know, I was going to spend, you know, I wanted to do kind of two tours in Bangalore, two tours in Mumbai, Delhi, and some of the big cities. But yeah, so the idea was to start in Mumbai and then, you know, from there, you know, go to Pune, go to Hyderabad, go to Bangalore, Chennai, go to Goa. And then kind of circle back to Mumbai and then go north from there. So I think that was the basic idea. When I got into Mumbai, and I think I was obviously going on a pretty tight budget, because it was a pretty long trip. So it was going to be pretty expensive, and I knew I was going back to business school. So I kind of had to save money. So I was going on a pretty frugal budget. So I was staying in, you know, all sorts of, and this was before really Airbnb got big. In India. And so I was staying in, you know, all these sort of like 3-star hotels that were, you know, this is obviously well before Oyo started as well. So I was staying in all these like budget hotels, which were, you know, honestly pretty bad, you know, not very nice accommodations, sure. And, you know, I think that the challenge was a lot of these people, like the places, like the guys like didn't really speak very good English. You know, and there were a lot of issues, like a lot of places didn't have AC. That was proper. A lot of them had, like, you know, a lot of, you know, mosquitoes and, you know, there were just a lot of issues that way. So like when I first got to Mumbai, when I landed, I remember it was the middle of the night, or it was like, you know, 1 a.m. maybe. So yeah, pretty late. And, you know, I got out, you know, I had a big suitcase and then I had two packs, because I was going to be traveling for the, you know, 3 months. And yeah, I actually remember I couldn't get a cab, so I had to take a rickshaw from the airport. And yeah, I was taking a rickshaw from there to Andheri East. So my hotel was in Andheri East, and it was a pretty small budget hotel. And so obviously this was before Google Maps was big in the city, in the country. And so yeah, then the rickshaw drivers, of course, obviously don't really speak much English. So it was pretty hard. And then, you know, the hotel, like, you know, the guy, like there was like not a proper number for the hotel. And so the guy, the rickshaw driver couldn't reach him. And then, you know, he didn't really know where it was. So it was, we ended up, and it was very tough because I had all of my bags. So I couldn't like just like get out and get a new, like hail a new car or rickshaw cab on the street. So I, you know, I ended up taking like an hour and a half to find the hotel. It was a crazy situation. And so this was in the middle of the summer. This was in April, so it was obviously.
Were you stressing out, or was it like a fun adventure?
No. At that point, well, I mean, yeah, not really stressing out. Like, I knew at some point, yeah, we would find it. I mean, it was just going to take time. I think, yeah, there are obviously a number of those experiences of the first few weeks, and yeah, I realized that you should have to, you know, be patient. I mean, you definitely learn patience pretty quickly in those situations because. Yeah, I mean, stressing out over something like that. Yeah, I never. I mean, look, I'm not. Yeah, personally, I'm not the kind of person who stresses out really about anything that way. I kind of take it all in stride, you know, because I know that, you know, that's not productive, it's not logical, it's not constructive. So it never really leads anywhere. So there's no point of doing that. I think, yeah, you have to kind of, you know, really relish the experience. And yeah, you know, the way to think about it is, yeah, you know, it's going to be a really good story one day. And so I think
that's true.
That's all. Okay.
What are the stories from that first trip in India? Stuff that is still vivid in your mind?
Yeah, you know, there's dozens of dozens of stories. I mean, I think, you know, certainly, you know, it was, you know, I think what was really cool about, you know, the trip was, you know, it was an opportunity to obviously do a huge amount of business diligence on ground, but you know, you could kind of mix that with being a tourist.
Did you come to India with an agenda that you want to explore it as a business destination?
Yeah, well, I knew that. Yeah, so coming in, I knew that I wanted to do Zoomcar. So at that point.
Oh, really? Yeah. Okay. So while you were at International Power before joining B School, you already knew that you want to start something in India.
Yeah. So I knew that we wanted to do something in the transport space and wanted to do something in the, you know, kind of the consumer facing mobility side, you know, within, you know, personal mobility. And, you know, that was definitely, you know, something which was front and center for us. And the trip is really confirmatory due diligence. And,
What do you mean by we? Like you had
my co-founder and I.
Okay.
Yeah.
And how did you meet your co-founder?
We were friends from school, undergrad at Penn.
Okay.
We're buddies from there.
So like India was one of the options that you were exploring, or you were clear that, okay, we want to do mobility in India?
Well, I think we were clear in India, and then I think we were pretty clear on mobility in India as well. Just given the, as I think I mentioned, you know, it's, if you want to do something in, you know, renewable energy, broader sustainability on the power infrastructure side, it's pretty tough because, you know, it's a long slog, it's a long haul, very expensive, you know, very slow approvals, procedures, just not something that you can really do in a very short period of time. So simply put, and I think that was really for us, at least what, you know, kind of came out. And so, yeah, we wanted to, you know, make sure that, you know, we were going to be able to do something that could scale. So I think that's why we looked at what we did.
Okay. Yeah. But I mean, how did the idea of India come into your mind? Like, I mean, you have never visited India, you know, how did that idea originate that, okay, I'll do this in India?
As I mentioned, you know, it was something where I had a lot of professional experience in India in my earlier jobs where, you know, there were a lot of deals and a lot of opportunities that we looked at in India. So, yeah, that was, you know, for like 3 years, right? So 3 years, 4 years. So I think that really helped. And, you know, that obviously was an important driving factor, motivating factor. Also, as I think I mentioned, you know, at UPenn, you know, I ended up meeting a lot of friends, meeting a lot of guys and good buddies from India. And so, yeah, even from the time I was in college. So, you know, I had a chance to meet with their families as well when they would visit. Their, you know, dads or moms would talk about, you know, India as a destination and as a sort of a commercial opportunity as well. So I think that it was certainly helping and conspiring and influencing me in that direction, which I think was good. And then, you know, finally, even coming back to when I was in school, I also studied a lot about India. About like, you know, history, political economy, you know, even the food. So all of that was certainly there in a favorable way.
Okay. So your co-founder David was also traveling with you when you came to India, or
actually he was not. So he was in the U.S. Due to job constraints at the time. But so I ended up doing all of that digging and being on ground myself. So yeah, that was also something which made it, you know, on some levels, you know, very exciting because when you're traveling alone, it's very empowering, right? You have to kind of just go and make something happen,
right?
As opposed to being with someone else. So there's a different level of proactiveness.
Was like a reconnaissance mission in a way.
Yeah, exactly. That's more or less, as I said there, it's, you know, kind of a lot of fact finding, a lot of diligence, etc. And that was, you know, for 3 to 4 months.
And what was your takeaway at the end of it? Like, did you think that, yes, it's doable? Did you form a thesis on how you should do it and stuff like that?
No, I mean, I think definitely. So, I mean, more than anything, I would say it really motivated me in a big way to kind of get after it. And, you know, it really strengthened, I would say, you know, really fortified the conviction around what we were doing. And, you know, basically said that, you know, this is, you're barking up the right tree. You know, you should be just going more, you know, at a all out pace and go, you know, head first and go 1,000 miles an hour to make this happen. So I think that's really kind of what came out pretty quickly.
And so you joined USC Marshall School of Business. And so when you joined, you were already clear that, okay, you're going to start a mobility business in India. Then obviously that experience in the B school would all be through those lens only, I'm guessing.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. No, for sure. And, you know, again, there I was fortunate that, you know, we had, I think, like 10 or 11 people from our year who were from India, were in the school with us in the class, and maybe 220, 230 kids in the class, in each year. So yeah, so a decent, number. And yeah, I mean, it was something where, you know, I actually, you know, always felt that, you know, they were, you know, very helpful and, you know, certainly insightful. And, you know, I ended up, you know, a lot of connections I ended up making, with, you know, the community in India, you know, actually came from them. In fact, one of them ended up investing, and became a, you know, good friend. So yeah, I mean, it's something which definitely was useful and was very helpful. And, you know, I think when you're starting out a venture, it's, you know, I actually recommend this to a lot of people who are aspiring to be entrepreneurs, but one of the best times to start is actually in business school, because you just have a little bit more flex, a little bit more time, quite frankly. So if you're going to start, you know, starting in your first year of business school or second year of business school is a great time to start. I think the only downside to that is, you know, sometimes if you need to, you know, invest money or put in money. So like, you know, a lot of startups are, you know, almost all startups, in fact, are bootstrapped to start. And you know, almost 100% of startups have founders put in money, right? So that's there in almost every case that I've ever seen. You know, it ranges, of course, you know, it can range from, you know, 5 lakhs to, you know, 5 crores. But yeah, so it's, you know, something which, you know, of course you want to do, and it's actually a big red flag if you don't. So yeah, so that's why like 99% of people do, to some level. And, yeah, so that's why it's a good time to typically do it, in college or in undergrad or graduate rather, whether it's MBA or master's or whatever you're doing. So I think for me, it was, yeah, obviously an MBA course, 2-year course, but I ended up sticking around only for a year and dropping out after that. The first year was really crazy because I was, you know, working, you know, full steam in school, and I started the energy club, and I was the president, and I was rallying there and doing a lot of clean tech work. And so part of that was kind of like a hedge in the event that Zoomcar wasn't working out. And then overnight, because the time difference, like basically from like 11 p.m. onwards, I would work on Zoom, and I would call people in India. Yeah, I would be doing a lot of different work. And, you know, that was really tough because, you know, you would just, you know, you'd be exhausted because you're working a full day, you're working a full 14-hour day, and then you're coming back and working, you know, 6 hours, 7 hours, 8 hours overnight.
Wow. You would 2-3 hours of sleep a day.
Yeah, you'd sleep for like 2-3 hours a night consistently. And yeah, you just, I mean, that's the way it works. And so, yeah, I did that for the whole year. And so, yeah, it was something where it was really intense. It was pretty hardcore. I mean, yeah, I would say it's kind of like I still remember I'm a big fan of Tesla. And I always remembered, you know, hearing Elon Musk, post, you know, some of their problems when they were scaling up their Model 3, where he was like, you know, it was really, really, I just remember he was saying it was like really, really hardcore, and he's like sleeping on the factory floor. And I remember I was like, well, I think that was maybe like 2017 or 18 for those guys, maybe like years ago. But I remembered, I was like hearing Elon Musk say that, I was like, I can obviously, you know, he's a, you know, an unbelievably successful entrepreneur, but yeah, you know, I can totally relate to that because, you know, I wasn't sleeping on the factory floor, but I might as well have been doing that because it was just like an insane, it was just a totally insane experience for that year as you were starting off. And so I think, you know, so many entrepreneurs have that experience, but I think for me, it was probably a little unique because I was having to do it remotely, you know, phoning a different country. And then, you know, at that point, again, you know, connectivity, it wasn't like you had WhatsApp, right? So it was all on Skype, and it was like, you know, terrible connection. Like you were calling from a Skype number to a Indian mobile number. And this was like way before Reliance Jio came. You know, this was when Airtel and Vodafone had pretty pathetic penetration in the country in 2011, 2012. So yeah, it was very tough. It was very, very tough. I mean, you know, had I known it was going to be so tough, you know, I might not have done it. It's probably good that I didn't know it was so tough going into it.
Yeah. Okay. So what were you doing in that 1 year on the Zoom project? Like, did you narrow down that you want to start as a car rental service? Or, like, you know, tell me about how the idea evolved over that year to where you finally left P school and got on the ground.
Yeah. So I think remarkably little changed actually from the time, you know, so prior to India, you know, we had already, prior to visiting India rather, we had already kind of drawn out the entire business plan. Everything was kind of put together.
What was the original plan, that you'll purchase cars and then like rent them out?
Well, yeah, purchasing cars was never really, I mean, it wasn't like we were prescriptive where it's like, we're going to buy cars or we're not going to buy cars. We wanted to just acquire. I mean, ideally, like initially we figured we could aggregate them and then, you know, not buy cars. I mean, ideally, look, if you can obviously avoid buying cars, if you can just you know, onboard them onto the platform,
that aggregate that. Them how, like, there was no, I mean, so and I'll tell you what I'm confused about. Like, say someone like an Uber could aggregate because they were already taxi service providers, but India didn't have a car rental industry as such. So what would you be aggregating? I mean, you were basically in the rental space only, right? Or were you looking at a shared taxi, like a Uber kind of a?
No. So we were always looking at, you know, something on the personal mobility side where you were going to drive yourself. So that was always the case. We looked at the taxi market and the ride hailing space. You know, at that point, Uber was just coming up in the US. And I think, you know, we never believed that model worked. And I think, you know, I think we are proven correct, right? So I think Uber and Lyft have obviously been failed companies. You know, there's been, you know, none of the ride hailing companies globally have worked. Ola has obviously totally pivoted their business and, you know, basically are shutting down their ride hailing business, right? So they're hardly doing anything out there. You know, now they're pivoted to be an electric scooter manufacturer. So it shows that I think we, you know, not to toot our own horns there, but I think we had a good amount of prescience, knowing that that model was really not going to succeed long term. And yeah, I think that's proven out, you know, today. So I think, at least in terms of profitability. So I think the point there was, you know, for us at least, personal mobility was always the answer, because it was always going to be cheaper. It was always going to be, you know, less costly. It was going to always have a more profitable market opportunity. So that was something which made it, you know, I think, you know, always more appealing. And
how would you get the supply in place? Because there wasn't any, like, existing car rental agencies in India that you could aggregate and...
That wasn't really true, right? So there was always a lot of small-time mom-and-pop tours and travels guys. So initially we were thinking we would just aggregate from those guys, or, you know, aggregate from individuals, actually. But then I think what we realized early on was that, you know, the regulation was actually pretty tight and was not allowing for those type of aggregation models. So ultimately, you know, we ended up landing on the whole purchasing of vehicles because there was just no other alternative. So that was, you know, yeah, obviously I don't think anyone is going to go in and say, like, you know, I want to have to spend more money and do more effort to get inventory, right? Like, if you had an option, I don't think anyone would necessarily advocate for that option first. So I think, yeah, it's more... Yeah, and justifying the means and kind of as long as the cat catches the mouse. So I think that's really more important for us. I think, you know, what we realized was that, you know, going and buying cars and going with the license and getting that whole process, it was going to take longer to do that, but it would also be a competitive advantage once you kind of got through it, because one, you would need licensing, right? You would need capital and all that. So that was, I think, kind of the reason overall.
But did you have money to buy cars, or you did a angel round or something? Like,
as I mentioned, you know, we put in, my co-founder and I put in some of our own money, and then, you know, we also raised a couple hundred thousand dollars, so a couple crores, we had raised at that point, as we were starting the business. And that allowed us to kind of get access to more cars. And so we started off with just 7 cars in Bangalore. Yeah, I still remember we had 4 Ford Figos and 3 Mahindra Scorpios. And I still remember the license plate numbers, 1148 to 1154 series KA. So I still remember everything about the first vehicle delivery where we actually did a home delivery to the customer who is in his office in Coromandel, and he handed us a bag of cash. all of this was, of course, totally, this is, of course, very clean. This was all legitimate, it was funny because it was a bag of cash. I think it was like 13,000 rupees or something because, we didn't have a functioning payment gateway at the time. We hadn't even gone live with the website, the integration yet. So it was kind of like a pre-sale. So the only thing we could do is take cash because there were no ways you couldn't take like a remote digital credit card where, there were mobile POS systems at that point. They were just launched in 2012. But the problem out there was, that they were not reliable and they were very expensive. Mm-hmm. So it was not very
efficient. How did you actually get the initial things done? Like, is it easy for a person who's not an Indian citizen to start a private limited company and
buy cars
and stuff like that?
No, of course not. Very difficult. At that point, it was extremely difficult. Now today, it's a little bit easier. It's still not that easy for foreigners. But it was brutal because the process for us. So we actually set up largely the Indian entity from the US, which made it even tougher because the whole KYC issue. I remember probably having to send my passport, my visa, my photos 7 or 8 times, at least maybe more. I remember because I was in Boston for a summer working between first and second year before I left. That was really painful because I had to go and, work with FedEx and UPS and the post. I was there so many times. I must have visited the post office 6 or 7 times and over the course of three weeks, maybe. And I was no one should ever have to visit the post office ever. It's not a good experience. It's like going to the DMV, which is like the RTO in the US. So it's no one wants to go to the RTO or the STA office. And so same thing goes like the US post office. It's pretty, pretty terrible. But you have to do what you have to do, right? There's no shortcuts around it. And I think the difficulties in all of those logistical setups for us early on, it gave us a lot of patience and it really taught us that, as an entrepreneur, 90% of what you do, especially in the first 1 or 2 years, it's not glamorous at all, right? There's nothing glamorous about having to run to the post office 7 times in 3 weeks and sit there for hours and, go and call people in India for hours to get a signature or get documents in place. And, for the first 12 months of even operating the business, it was one logistical mess after another, nothing even tied to business. It was just admin work, where you just had to do the first year of our business, I was so bogged down. When people asked me, how do you spend your time? And I spent over half my time on admin and, they were that's insane, right? No one would ever choose. Why would you do that? It's not good for any business. So it's a major distraction. It's a major dissuading point for any entrepreneur, especially a local Indian entrepreneur as well. So it's just not good. I mean, I think the government now has, they made some strides, but they claim to be very, entrepreneur friendly, but that's just wrong. That's just not the case. The government's not entrepreneur. Yeah, it's a joke, right? I mean, how can you, if you come out with rules, saying that you're going to, have 1% GST, tax through cash, right? Or if you even, think about, making, startups pay GST, at that point, it was that or service techs. I mean, how can you possibly do that, right? Like, if you're just starting off and you're just starting making revenue, like, why would you ever have to pay tax when you're just starting? It doesn't make any sense. So the point is that, yeah, there's the policy regime is just very off. And the incentives are just not
basically, you know, the Indian government operates with a trust deficit. So, you know, so for example, if they were to make things more relaxed, then the biggest fear would be that people would manipulate and, you know, take advantage and find loopholes. And, you know, someone has an existing business which is doing well. He doesn't want to pay GST. He just starts a new company, claims it's a startup. So, right. You know, there are those trust deficit issues in the society as a whole, you know, until they don't get solved. Probably right. The ease of doing business will remain.
Yeah, but of course, I mean, the alternative is much worse, right? Like, you know, just, I mean, the point is that the bad actors are, you know, 1%. So the point is that, you know, even if you have bad actors, you know, so you know, even if you have leakage, I mean, so the real argument is, you know, okay, so what? I mean, it's 1%. What's the big deal? The growth that you have from, you know, the 99%, just totally washes out that leakage that's there from the 1 or 2%. So and that's been proven, you know, time and time again everywhere globally. So it's just not good logic. It's just not well founded. It's not based on any data. So, which is, I think, the problem. Anyway, I mean, not to digress, but I think that's something which is a systemic issue. And yeah, it made it really, really frustrating for us as we were, you know, building out, you know, the business.
So you landed in India in mid-2012 with a couple of crores and with the incorporation done. So then what did you do next? Like, you bought the cars and you launched a website and started generating demand?
It wasn't quite so easy. I mean, it was more the first 3-4 months, it was all just a race to get sort of the licensing and the permitting and figuring out, you know, those modalities.
You had to get a commercial license for these cars?
Eventually. Initially, though, it was working with a partner who already had a license, because it was clear that there was no way for us to obtain a license straight away. Because we needed to have all sorts of, like, you know, pretty wild requirements, which we just didn't have. So, yeah, we realized that it was going to be pretty tough and a bit of a slog.
So you got into a rental arrangement or something with that partner where you would pay him a rental for the cars and something like that.
Right. That's right. That's right. Yeah. It was basically sort of a rental model type. It was almost like an operating lease to this individual, to this small tourism jobless player. So we worked with him exclusively for a 12-month period.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And how did you generate demand?
Yeah. Initially, we generated demand just through really strong word of mouth. We didn't spend marketing money at all for the first 2 years. We didn't invest anything for the first 2 years. So it was all about, you know, just creating that positive buzz, word of mouth in the market, a lot of referrals, and then, you know, it spread that way. And, you know, we did some, you know, ground activation, so to speak, at petrol bunks, so diesel bunks. So. That way, you know, definitely, potentially makes sense. And, you know, then we had a couple of, you know, strong alliances, where, you know, it helped us kind of build more credibility, I would say. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So initially, what was it? Was it like a on-demand car? Like, you just book it and it reaches your home? Or did you have to go to some pickup point and pick it up the way it is in the West? Or like...
So early on, it was a self-pickup model where you had to kind of go, you know, into one of these distributed parking facilities, which is going to be across the city. So, you know, that was actually always the focus.
So, so by end of 2012, you had like 7 cars and you were in Bangalore. So how did that proceed? Like, by end of 2013, where were you at? And
Right. So it was pretty wild the first year. As I said, there was huge amount of time just spent on general admin and trying to get, you know, all of these licenses and, you know, approvals in place and, you know, just registrations in place. So you know, leaving that, you know, notwithstanding, but you know, I think the focus for us was on getting our primary self-drive permit, which ended up coming in the first quarter of 2014. So that was like a 12-month plus process. So that was the big one for us, because we knew that, you know, that was the limitation to our supply growth. So you know, without having that in place, there was no way that we were going to be able to grow supply, because our existing our first partner, the tourism travelers company that we were working with, you know, he had a constraint and a limitation where he couldn't take cars beyond a certain point. So we kind of took him to 50 cars, you know, just sort of 50 cars, and we couldn't, you know, go and add any more cars with him. And so, yeah, that was the constraint. So I think ultimately it was just about getting that permit so then we could ultimately purchase cars on our own.
Okay. Yeah. This must have been a capital intensive scale up. You would have needed to raise a lot of funding since you were purchasing the cars.
Yeah. So initially it was, you know, because we, you know, also you couldn't really get that much debt, right? So, I mean, it was always, you know, on debt. So, you know, there was never a doubt that you need to have significant debt, because, you know, there's no way that you can buy cars on equity, right? So, yeah, that's just too much money, and you know, it's just not very productive ROA. So yeah, it was definitely something where my finance background helped a lot, because I had a, you know, expertise actually in debt. I had done a lot of structured debt, a lot of project finance debt, so asset-backed debt. So I non-recourse debt was something I knew, you know, quite well, and I think that also probably is one of the reasons why we're able to get so much debt is because I actually had a personal professional background in that beforehand.
How soon did you tap the market for funds, like be it debt or VC funding? Like,
well, they're very different, right? So you know, VC funding, we, you know, we're always talking to folks in the very beginning. So you know, that was something where, you know, we had individual investors come in, and then, you know, gradually institutions, small institutions, and much larger. So, I mean, our first sort of VC, you know, VC PE investor was Sequoia, and that was the end of 2014. So that was about 6 years back. And then from there,
how did that happen? Like your skills previously of which you learned while you were at Fieldstone of getting new business, like they must have helped you here in terms of networking and opening doors of VCs and stuff like that?
Yeah, no, I think it certainly helped to a point. You know, I think it's more about just like getting your foot in the door. And I think from there, you kind of take it ahead. But it's really, you know, for me, you know, having done a lot of, you know, as you said, sort of, you know, sales type work in investment banking, you know, where you kind of understand how to bring in different, you know, relationships into the mix. So certainly it was easier, I think, maybe to navigate that landscape and understand it a little bit better. But yeah, having said that, you know, at the end of the day, you know, that's just the beginning. It's just a starting line. So it's really about, you know, what you do from there that matters the most. And I think there was, you know, it's always been about execution. So the game has always been execution.
So you got Sequoia in as your first big institutional investor. And then, like, who were the others?
So over time, we brought in other institutions like Nokia, Nokia Growth Partners, Our Crowd, Ford Motor Company, Mahindra. So you know, these names came in over the years. And you know, then more recently, like Sony. So Sony Ventures, which is one of that's their venture arm of Sony. So yeah, we had a mix of, I would say, financial investors, sort of like VCs, PEs, and then combining that, you know, with OEMs. So it's, you know, it's always been a pretty balanced overall endeavor, I would say.
Was it tough getting money from Mahindra? I mean, considering that Mahindra is like an old school Indian business conglomerate, who typically does not do, Indian business conglomerates have not typically been doing like VC funding, startup funding, though now they have, but at right. that time it must have been, you must have been one of the earliest ones.
Yeah, you know, so they hadn't done too much. So I think there were a few examples before us, but yeah, I think it obviously depends, you know, what group company you're talking about. because you know, we were actually in M&M, we were on the automotive side. So it was a little bit different. But yeah, I think it helped that Ford actually had done an investment earlier. And so even at that point of time, Ford and Mahindra were working on this broader alliance, this strategic partnership. So I think that also helped on many levels. Hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. You got to meet Anand Mahindra also?
That's right. Yeah. So I met Anand a few times. So that was obviously, you know, certainly quite an experience. So not something you'll ever sort of forget. I mean, his office alone is pretty incredible. I mean, we met, I still remember the first time we met was, if you're familiar with Bombay, you know, it's actually all the way down in South Bombay, you know, right near, actually right behind the Taj Hotel, the Taj Mahal Hotel, where the, unfortunately, where the attacks were in 2008. So yeah, so it's basically right behind that. There's a little lane, there's an alley, if you will. And, you know, Mahindra has, you know, their, you know, old school, like really old corporate office there, where I guess the broader Mahindra family had sat over a couple of generations. And, you know, that whole area was built up by the Britishers a long time ago in the 1800s. But yeah, so that was, you know, a really beautiful old building, like the super old British, like colonial building. And it was, you know, kind of transformed. It was like a, you know, two-story, three-story building. So it's all kind of like low-slung buildings that are really old, really nicely maintained. You know, it's kind of restored. And yeah, the office itself is like stunning. You walk in, it's, you know, it's kind of like, you know, Tata has a very similar office. I think it's like the Bombay House, but where all the top management sits. And, you know, it's the same thing here where Anand personally sits. And yeah, you know, the office, it was just like super over the top. It was like incredibly nice. And so, yeah, I remember, you know, waiting for, you know, maybe about 20 minutes outside with his assistant and then finally getting, you know, ushered in. And then, yeah, I think the meeting, yeah, it ended up being a pretty long meeting. It was like probably 45, 50 minutes, you know, which I think for guys like that, usually it's a pretty long meeting. So yeah, it was good. You know, I got to hear his vision, his thought process for, you know, the group and, you know, how he was thinking about some of these new trends. And, you know, I think it was clear that, you know, he had, you know, at a high level, at a broad level, understanding the direction, the vision they wanted to take Mahindra in. But I think in terms of the, you know, double clicking on, you know, more of the sort of implementation strategy, I think that was where it was obviously still getting fleshed out. I think that's where, you know, he felt that, you know, partnership, investment partnership with Zoomcar potentially could help, you know, lubricate that and facilitate that, you know, broader vision, you know, one level down. So I think that was probably the motivating factor behind it, I would say.
Hmm, okay. Yeah. Okay. And so, you know, like, tell me about how your revenue has kind of grown over the years. Like, what kind of revenue did you do in the first year and how has that shaped up over the years?
Oh, well, yeah, in the first year, we did like, you know, around $1 million or so. Yeah, so it was quite nominal, quite de minimis. And so, you know, that consistently grew over time as we added more and more vehicles and saw more and more transactions, more and more customers coming through the door. So yeah, for us, I mean, the prime, you know, way of generating revenue is from having more units, by having more vehicles. So that was ultimately the name of the game. You know, the more vehicles you have, the more revenue you can generate. So it was always a game of, you know, how many vehicles you can amass.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. So what kind of revenue do you do now? Like, are you at liberty to tell us?
I mean, we can't really talk about the exact numbers, but, you know, we've crossed 75 million of annual revenue. And so, you know, we're north of that. And then obviously, I mean, with COVID, you know, COVID's been an interesting situation because we were obviously locked down for a number of months, but, you know, we've seen a very strong bounce back, for post COVID.
Okay. So, and your product itself has also evolved. So initially you started with only cell-phoned vehicles, but, you know, tell me about that evolution, how the product and services that you were offering, how they evolved over the years.
So we have a couple of product offerings now today. I mean, when we started, it was just one product. It was about short-term access. So hourly daily rental. So you can take a vehicle for a couple of hours, take it for a couple of days. So short-term access was the first product for the first couple of years. Then sort of 2017-18 came along and we realized that there was a huge unmet market opportunity there, a need in the long-term access market. And that's where, you know, we wanted to push ahead with a vehicle digital subscription. And so we created the first long-term access product in India for personal mobility by creating a 100% digitized car subscription and have that as a service. And, you know, so we also introduced alongside that sort of what we believed at the time, and you still believe that for sure today, is that like a killer app feature, you know, which is actually allowing the individual subscribers to share back their vehicles on the Zoomcar short-term rental platform when the car is idle, when the car is not in use. And so as a result, this whole share back dynamic, it's more like an Airbnb marketplace type. So it's more of a managed marketplace type, you know, two-sided there. And, you know, so this actually is, you know, quite powerful, because what it does is at the end of the day, it reduces the monthly obligation of the subscriber. So it brings it down by, you know, 50, 60, 70%, depending on how many days the subscriber is actually listing and sharing the car.
Okay.
Yeah.
So who would go for a long-term subscription? Like, so you're saying this is an alternative to buying a car, like don't buy a car, instead subscribe to a car.
Yes. So the idea is, yeah, actually you don't need to buy a car. You can subscribe. I think if you really look at it, it's really about, you know, having something out there, you know, which is going to be very, very convenient, very, very flexible and very affordable.
Convenient because you don't need to do the maintenance, like Zoomcar would do the maintenance.
I think it's not just that. I mean, if you look at it, there's the whole, you know, the fact that, you know, service maintenance is included, insurance is included, the taxation, all that's included. So there's really nothing else over and above.
The hassles of car ownership are like kind of outsourced to Zoomcar, and I just have a car
when I need it. Yeah, the whole, exactly. Yeah, the whole idea is that this is really, you know, outside of that, so auspice. So you don't have to worry about, you know, anything that's going to be ancillary, miscellaneous, out of pocket. More than anything, that's actually quite powerful for folks.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and this you can also save money when you rent it out when it's lying idle.
That's right. Yeah, the whole idea is that, you know, it's, you know, super efficient that way. You actually can save, and, you know, it's more in sync with your usage pattern.
But if the car is in my driveway, then do I need to drive it to some place to rent it out?
No, that's the beauty of it, is that it's, you know, super, super convenient, where individual renters can actually go and pick up the vehicle at your house. And there's a keyless entry system through your smartphone. So the smartphone actually unlocks the car. So you don't need to be physically present. You don't need to be there handing over keys. You don't need to have, there's no paperwork. The car doesn't need to be moved and reallocated or relocated. So that way it's much, much easier.
When did you implement this keyless system?
That's been there almost from the beginning. It was there in, you know, initially there was a version one of it that, you know, was there for some time, unfortunately, the technical aspects of it didn't work out that well. So we kind of shut that and then relaunched it in 2016. So it's
in-house.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So initially we were working with third parties. We realized that was not scalable. There were a lot of challenges on the tech infra side. So we realized that we had to bring those capabilities in-house. And that's actually now, you know, a precursor to kind of one of our current business lines, which is around enterprise SaaS. So our next product has been around enterprise SaaS and really focusing on mobility technology as a service.
What is this product? Tell me more about this.
Well, this is, I'm sure you would have seen ZMS, Zoomcar Mobility Services. So this is our B2B enterprise SaaS offering. And so, you know, we effectively offer, you know, two core products. One is vehicle connectivity as a service, so IoT as a service. Which is around, like, you know, real-time, you know, driver scoring, vehicle health monitoring, the real-time digital access, digital remote access.
The enterprise would get a dashboard where they can log in and see all the data about their.
So that's part of it. It's a hardware come software solution. So that's part of it. It's really the IoT connectivity as a service side is really oriented towards different fleets, and that's more fleet owner operators more than anything else, and different vehicle form factors. So that's over there. The other pillar for us is sort of the vehicle yield management services, which is effectively a like revenue maximization function. And for that, it's giving aspects of our subscription software and our renter software, and exposing that from a white labeling standpoint to OEMs, to dealer distributors, or to the fleet owner operators. So,
give me an example of this,
So we work with a number of OEMs. So we work now with multiple OEMs in India, where we have white labeled, and so that's something where we'll be announcing a lot more of those partnerships very soon. But all of the top OEMs now in India, we're working with on this white labeling, where they actually white label our software as a service.
So like Mahindra could, for example, be using this where instead of buying a Mahindra car, you subscribe to a Mahindra car, and that is powered by Zoom at the back end. Is that what this is?
Right. So it's white labeled. So it doesn't like say anything about powered by Zoom car, but the whole idea is that at the back end. So the whole point is that the consumer, you see Mahindra subscription. So yeah, that's right. So that's the whole idea.
Yeah, okay.
Well, very seamless, very simple. But if you think about it, the OEMs, they really want to be the brand owners. So they really desire to be the brand owners. So that's something which is really important, is that they want to be the custodian of the customer journey and really have that sort of end-to-end. Yeah.
Okay. And so the products you've told me so far, you have these two enterprise products, IoT and the white labeled solution, and you have short-term ride within the city and long-term subscribe to a car. What else?
So those are the products. Those are the three core products.
What about intercity? Can you pick up the car at one place and drop it at another place?
You can do that. We don't really consider that a different product because that's still within short-term rental. Within short-term rental, we have intercity one way. We have intra-city one way, flexible, sort of free float drop. We have airport pickup. We have railway station pickup. So there is also a sort of a commute type product, which is like a 2-week rental, which gives you much lower kilometers. So there's a number of quote unquote like micro products within the broader macro product.
And so David went back to the US a couple of years back. So why did he was India too much for him or what?
It was mainly for personal reasons. I mean, he was actually getting married. And his wife wanted to be in the States. And so it was proving to be a little difficult logistically, personally that way. That was really the prime motivating factor for him.
So what are the technologies that you are currently investing in for the next phase of Zoom Car?
Right. So I think, we're very big, obviously, on AI, ML, probably obvious reasons. It relates to the vehicle and the algorithms that come from the vehicle in terms of, predictive maintenance, driver scoring, vehicle health monitoring. So that's all artificial intelligence, machine learning based. That's one piece. So for our data science team plus engineering. And then the other piece is CV and computer vision. So computer vision is very important for us as we think about the use cases tied to vehicle safety in terms of the dash cameras, et cetera. And then also, we have significant CV capabilities as it relates to some of the operational processes. So a lot of the image recognition, image detection, damage detection on the vehicles, a lot of that is actually done through CV, computer vision. And then even sort of real-time selfie verification matching. So if I want to match my selfie vis-a-vis something I had done earlier, so then I can do that.
So that was the journey of Zoomcar, from an idea in Greg's mind to being a market disruptor. And if you're fed up of being locked up inside your home for months and want to hit the road, consider the sustainable option of renting a car from Zoomcar for the next road trip.
If you like the Founder Thesis podcast, then do check out our other shows on subjects like marketing, technology, career advice, books, and drama. Visit thepodium.in, that is thepodium.in, for a complete list of all our shows.